When I met Sam in school, he was pretty obsessed with the disappearance of his dad, who just didn't come home from the grocery store one day. They found his truck and his glasses on the ground next to the truck. You know, those glasses that you see him carrying around all the time? Six turns to look inside the back door. Wait, those are his dad's? Yeah. And so the deal is that Sam is pretty convinced he was abducted by aliens, which I always thought was crazy, but I don't know. I let him go on believing it because who am I to crush the dude's hope of finding his dad again? I was waiting for Sam to tell you all this, but I just read Henri's letter, and you wouldn't believe what was in there.
What?
I tell her everything. About Sam's dad being a Lorik ally who met Henri and me when the ship landed, why Henri moved us to paradise. Six slides off the top of the picnic table and lands awkwardly on the bench.
That is just so totally random that Sam is here, in there.
I don't think it is. I mean, think about it. It just so happens that of all the people in paradise I'm drawn to for a best friend, it happens to be Sam. I think we were destined to meet.
Maybe you're right.
Pretty cool that his dad helped us that night, right?
The coolest.
Remember when he said he had these feelings growing inside him about being with us?
I do.
But here's the thing. In Henri's letter, he says that Sam's dad actually was abducted, or maybe even killed, by the Mogadorians. We sit in silence, watching the sun slowly come up over the horizon. Bernie Kosar jogs out of the forest and rolls onto his back to have his belly rubbed.
Hey there, Hadley.
He flips onto his feet instantly when I say it, tilting his beagle head.
Yeah, I say, jumping down to scratch his chin with both hands. I know.
Sam walks out. His eyes are red. He sits next to Six on the bench.
Hi, Hadley,
Sam says to Bernie Kosar. BK barks in response and licks his hands.
Hadley?
Six asks. The dog barks again in approval.
I always knew it, Sam says. Always. The day he disappeared.
You were right all this time, I say.
Do you mind if I read the letter?
Six asks. Sam hands it to her. I aim my right palm at the front page and turn on its light. She reads the letter in its radiance, then folds the pages and hands them back.
I'm really sorry, Sam,
she says. I add, Henri and I wouldn't have survived if it wasn't for your dad. Six then turns to me.
You know, it's ridiculous that your parents were Liren and Lara. Or, it's ridiculous I didn't realize that myself. Do you remember me from Lorien, John? Your parents and my parents, their names were Arun and Lin. They were best friends. I know we weren't around our parents all that often, but I remember going to your house a few times. You were just a toddler at the time, I think.
It takes me a few seconds to remember what Henri once told me. It was the day Sarah had gotten back from Colorado, the day we confessed being in love with one another. After she left, Henri and I were eating dinner, and he said,
Though I don't know her number or have any idea where she is, one of the children who came to Earth with us was the daughter of your parents' best friends. They used to joke that it was fate that the two of you would end up together.
I almost tell Six what Henri said, but remembering how that conversation came about because of my feelings for Sarah brings back the same guilt I've felt since Six and I went for our walk.
Yeah, that is pretty crazy. I don't really remember it, though, I say.
Regardless, this is some heavy stuff about the elders and how we're supposed to assume their roles. No wonder the Moogs are so relentless, she says.
Definitely makes sense.
We have to go back to paradise, Sam interrupts.
Yeah, right, Six laughs. What we need to do is find the others somehow. We need to get back on that laptop, train some more.
Sam stands.
No, I'm serious, guys. We have to go back. If my dad left something behind, that transmission device, I think I know how to find it. When I was 7, he told me that my future was mapped on the sundial. I would ask him what he was talking about, and he'd just say that if the dark stars ever fell, I was supposed to find the Ennead and read the map by my birth date on the sundial.
What's an Ennead? I ask.
It's a group of 9 deities in Egyptian mythology.
9? Six asks. 9 deities? And what sundial? I ask.
It's starting to make sense to me now, Sam says.
He begins walking around the picnic table as he puts it together in his head, Bernie Kosar nipping at his heels.
I used to get so frustrated because he was always saying all this weird stuff that only he understood. A few months before he disappeared, my dad dug a well in our backyard and he said it would collect the rainwater from the gutters and whatever. But after the concrete was poured, he put this elaborate-looking sundial on the stone lid. Then he stood looking down at the well, and he said to me, "Your future's mapped on the sundial, Sam."
"And you never checked it out?" I ask.
"Sure I did. I twisted the sundial around, trying my date and time of birth and a few other things, but nothing ever happened. I thought it was just a stupid well with a sundial on it after a while. But now that I read Henri's letter, the part about the dark stars, I know that it has to be some kind of clue to all this. It's like he told me without telling me," Sam beams. "He was so smart."
"So are you," I say. "This could very well be suicide, us going back to paradise. But I don't think we have much of a choice now."
Chapter 19. I wake with clenched teeth, a sour taste in my mouth. I tossed and turned all night, not only because the chest is finally in my possession and I'm anxious to try to talk Adelina into opening it with me this morning, but also because I revealed too much to too many people. I put my legacies on full display. How much would they all remember? Will I be exposed before breakfast? I sit up and see Ella in her bed. Everyone is still asleep in the room, except for Gabby, La Gorda, Delfina, and Bonita. Their beds are empty. My feet are about to touch the ground when Sister Lucia appears in the doorway, her hands on her hips, her mouth twisted into a frown. We make eye contact, and I lose my breath. But then she takes a couple steps backwards and allows the 4 girls from the nave to wobble into the room, dazed and bruised, their clothes ripped and dirty. Gabby stumbles to her bed and falls face first onto it, the pillow enveloping her head. La Gorda rubs her double chin and lies back onto her bed with a grunt, and Bonita and Delfina slowly crawl under their covers. As soon as all 4 girls are motionless, Sister Lucia yells that it's time to get up.
"And that means everyone!"
As I try to pass by Gabby on the way to the bathroom, she flinches. La Gorda stands at the mirror inspecting the discoloration of her skin. When she sees my reflection over her shoulder, she immediately turns on the faucet and tries to focus on washing her hands. I can get used to this. I don't really want to intimidate people, but I like the idea I might be left alone. Ella skips out of one of the bathroom stalls and waits her turn at the sinks to wash up. I worry that she's going to be scared of me because of what I did in the nave, but the moment she sees me, Ella dramatically flexes her right hand over her head. I lean into her ear. "So you're okay?" "Thanks to you," she says loudly, I catch LaGuardia's eyes in the mirror.
Hey, I whisper. Last night is our little secret. Everything that happened last night is our secret, okay? Don't tell anyone.
She puts her finger to her closed lips, and I feel better.
But there's something about the way LaGuardia looked at me that doesn't sit well. I'm so preoccupied by what might be in the chest that I forego my morning internet search for news on John and Henri Smith. I don't have the patience to wait for morning mass to see Adelina, so I walk from room to room looking for her, but she's nowhere to be found. The first bell rings for morning mass. I shuffle in beside Ella in one of the last rows and wink at her. I locate Adelina in the front row. Halfway through mass, Adelina looks over her shoulder and makes eye contact with me. When she does, I point up to the nave's nook where she hid the chest so many years ago. Her eyebrows raise. I couldn't understand what you were saying, Adelina says after mass. The two of us stand under a stained glass window of St. Joseph on the left side of the nave, and we're bathed in a patchwork of muted yellows, browns, and reds. Her eyes match the seriousness of her posture. I found the chest.
Where?
I nod my head up and to the right.
I am the one who was supposed to decide when you're ready, and you are not ready. Not even close, she says angrily.
I pull my shoulders back and set my jaw.
I was never going to be ready in your eyes because you stopped believing, Emelina.
The name catches her off guard. She opens her mouth and stops before letting loose whatever tirade is on her tongue.
You have no idea what I'm going through in here with these other girls. While you're walking around holding onto your Bible and praying and counting the beads on your rosary, you don't care at all that I'm getting bullied, that I have just one friend, that all the sisters hate me, and that there's a whole world out there that I'm supposed to be defending. Two worlds, actually. Lorien and Earth need me, and they need you, and I'm holed up in here like an animal in the zoo, and you don't even care.
Of course I care. I start to cry.
No, you don't. No, you don't. Maybe you cared back when you were Odette, and maybe a little when you were Emelina. But ever since you've been Adelina, and I've been Marina, you haven't cared about me or the other eight, or what we're supposed to be doing here. I'm sorry, but I can't stand you talking to me about salvation when that's all I'm trying to achieve. I'm trying to protect us. I'm trying to do so much good, and you act as if I'm evil or something.
Adelina takes a step forward, her arms open for a hug. But something causes her to retreat and take a step back. Her shoulders bounce as she starts to cry. My arms immediately wrap around her and we embrace.
What's wrong? Why isn't Marina in the cafeteria?
We turn to see Sister Dora with her arms crossed over her chest. A copper crucifix hangs over her wrists.
Go, Adelina whispers. We'll talk about this later.
I wipe my face and rush past Sister Dora. As I leave the nave, I can hear snippets of a heated argument brewing between Sister Dora and Adelina, their voices echoing off the vaulted ceiling, and I run my hands through my hair in hope. Before sneaking back into the sleeping quarters last night, I floated the chest down the narrow, dark hallway to the left of the nave, past the ancient statues cut into the rock wall. It now sits hidden atop the narrow tower of the North Belfry, secure behind the padlocked oak door. It's safe there for the moment, but if I can't convince Adelina to open it with me soon, I'll have to find another location. Ella is nowhere to be found in the cafeteria, and I worry that my legacy has somehow backfired and she's at the hospital.
She's in Sister Lucia's office,
a girl says when I ask the girls at the table nearest the door.
There is a married couple with her. I think they're going to adopt her or something.
She pours a spoonful of soggy eggs onto her plate.
So lucky.
My knees buckle, and I catch myself from falling to the ground by gripping the edge of the table. I have no right to be so upset at the thought of Ella leaving the orphanage, but she's my one friend. Of course I knew she would be on the sisters' short list of adoptable girls. Ella is 7, and sweet, and cute, and wonderful to be around. I truly hope she finds a home, especially after losing her parents, but I'm not ready to let her go, regardless of how selfish it is. It was determined, when Adelina and I arrived, that I'd never be adopted. But I sit there now wondering if it might have been better if I was eligible. Maybe someone would have fallen in love with me. I realize that even if Ella is adopted today, it'll take some time for all the paperwork to be reviewed and accepted, which means she'll be here a week, maybe 2, maybe 3. But it still breaks my heart and makes me even more determined to leave this place as soon as I get the chest opened. I slump out of the cafeteria and find my coat, then sneak through the double doors and march down the hill, not caring that I'm skipping school. I keep an eye out for the man with the Pittacus book, staying on the sidewalk behind the vendors on Calle Principal, bouncing from shadow to shadow. As I walk past El Pescador, the village restaurant, I look down the cobblestone alley and see the lid of a trash can teeter and then crash to the ground. The trash can itself begins to quake and wobble, and I hear something scraping at its insides. A pair of black and white paws curl over the lip of the can. It's a cat, and when he struggles over the edge and lands on the alley floor, I see a long gash running along his right side. An eye is swollen shut. It looks as though he is about to fall over from exhaustion or starvation, and he just lies in a pile of trash as if he's given up. "You poor thing," I say. I know I'm going to heal him before I take my first step down the alley. He purrs when I kneel down next to him, and when I place my hand on his fur, there isn't resistance. The iciness flows quickly from me to the cat, quicker than it did to Ella or my own cheek, and I don't know if the legacy is getting stronger or if it works faster on animals. His legs straighten and paws spread wide, and his breathing picks up until it melts into a loud purr. I gently turn the cat over to inspect his right side and see that it's completely healed and covered with a lush coat of black fur. The eye that was swollen shut is now open and looking up at me. I name him Legacy and say, "If you want a ride out of town, Legacy, then we should talk, because I think I'm leaving soon and I could use the company." I'm startled by a figure appearing at the end of the alley, but it's just Hector, pushing his mother in the wheelchair.
"Ah, Marina of the Sea," he yells.
"Hi, Hector Ricardo."
I walk towards them. His mother looks slumped and distant, and I worry she's gotten worse.
"Who is your friend? Hello, little man."
Hector bends down to scratch Legacy's chin.
"Just some company I've picked up along the way."
We walk quietly, chatting about the weather and Legacy, until arriving at Hector and his mother's front door.
"Hector, have you seen the man with the mustache and book at the cafe recently?"
"No, I have not," he says. "What is it about this man that bothers you so much?"
I pause. "He just looks like somebody I know."
"Is that everything?"
"Yes." He can tell I'm lying, but also knows enough not to pry. I know he'll be on the lookout for the man I believe is a Mogadorian. I just hope he doesn't get hurt.
"It was good to see you, Marina. Remember that today is a school day."
He winks. I nod sheepishly, and he unlocks his front door, backing inside, pulling his sick mother along with him. The coast is clear over my shoulder, and I continue with my walk for a little while, thinking about the chest, when I will be able to talk again with Adelina. I also think about John Smith on the run. Ella and her possible adoption. My fight last night in the nave. At the end of Calle Principal, I stare at the school building, hating the front door and the windows, angry at all the time I've spent inside when I should have been on the move, changing my name with each new country. I wonder what I would name myself in America. Legacy meows around my feet as I make my way back through the village. I am still walking in the shadows, studying the street blocks ahead of me. I peek inside the window of the cafe, hoping and not hoping to see the Mogadorian with a thick mustache. He is not there. But Hector already is. And he's laughing at something the woman at the next table just said. I'm going to miss Hector, just as much as I'll miss Ella. I have two friends, not one. Ducking under the window as I pass, I can't help but look down at Legacy's lush, black-and-white fur coat. Less than an hour ago, the cat was lying in an alley, bleeding on a pile of trash, and now he's a ball of energy. My ability to heal and breathe new life into plants and animals and humans is an enormous responsibility. Fixing Ella made me feel more special than I ever had before, and it wasn't because I felt like a hero, but because I helped someone who needed it. I slink a few doors down the street, and Hector's laugh travels through the cafe window and wraps itself around my shoulders, and I know what I need to do. The front door is locked, but when I go around to the back of Hector's house, the first window I try opens with ease. Legacy licks his paws as I climb up and through the window. Jitters attack. I have never broken into someone's house before. The house is small and dark inside, and the air is heavy. Every foreseeable surface is covered with Catholic figurines. I find Hector's mother's room in no time. She lies on a twin bed in the far corner, her blankets slowly rising with each breath. Her legs are twisted at unnatural angles, and she looks frail. Pill bottles line a small nightstand, along with rosary beads, a crucifix, a miniature statue of the Virgin Mary with her hands held in prayer, and 10 or so saints I don't know the names of. I drop to my knees beside Carlota's sleeping body. Her eyes flutter open and scan the air. I freeze and hold my breath. I've never talked to her before. Though when she finds me crouching beside her, a glint of recognition registers. She opens her mouth to speak. "Shh," I say to her. "I'm a friend of Hector's, Señora Ricardo. I don't know if you can understand me, but I'm here to help you." She accepts what I have told her with fluttering eyelids. I reach up and caress the side of her cheek with the back of my left hand, and then I rest it on her forehead. Her gray hair is dry and brittle. She closes her eyes. My heart's pounding, and I can see a noticeable shake in my hand when I lift it and place it on her stomach. And it's then that I can feel how weak and sick she really is. The cold tingle crawls up my spine and spreads down my arms and into the tip of each finger. I grow dizzy. My breathing quickens, and my heart beats even faster. I begin to sweat despite the prickly chill turning my skin cold. Carlota's eyes open, and a low groan escapes her open mouth. I close my eyes. "Shh, it's okay. It's okay," I say to comfort the both of us. And then, with the icy chill radiating from me to her, I begin to pull the sickness away. It retreats stubbornly, clinging tightly to her insides, reluctant to loosen its grip. But finally, even the stubborn bits let go. Slight tremors cause Carlota to convulse and shake, and I do my best to hold her down. I open my eyes just in time to see the ashen color of Carlota's face change to a pink glow. Vertigo sweeps through me. I lift my hands from her body and fall backwards to the floor. My heart thuds so violently that it scares me, like it's about to break free from my body. But in time, it slows. And when I finally pull myself to my feet, I see Carlota's sitting up with a bewildered look, as though trying to remember where she is and how she'd gotten here. I rush into the kitchen and drink 3 glasses of water. When I walk back, Carlota is still gathering her bearings. I make another quick decision. I go to the nightstand and rifle through the 10 or so pill bottles, finding the label I'm looking for. Warning: may cause drowsiness. I open it, take 4 pills, and shove them in my pocket.
What's going on?
Carlota asks. She's frantic.
Where am I? Who are you?
I don't answer her, and instead walk from the room. But before I leave, I turn and look at Carlota once more. She's watching me, with her healed, untwisted legs dangling over the bed as though she's about to stand. I rush out of the house and find Legacy sleeping underneath the back window. Keeping to the alleys and side streets, I make my way back to the orphanage with the cat in my arms, wondering how Hector will react when he finds his mother cured. The problem, however, is that in a village this small, secrets don't last very long. My only hope is that nobody saw me come or go, and that Carlota won't remember what really happened. Outside the double doors, I unzip my coat halfway and carefully place Legacy inside. I know just where I can keep him safe. Up in the north belfry, with the chest. The chest, I think. I have to get it open.
Chapter 20. Being in love is a very strange thing. Your thoughts constantly drift towards this other person, no matter what you're doing. You could be reaching for a glass in the cupboard, or brushing your teeth, or listening to someone tell a story, and your mind will just start drifting towards their face, their hair, the way they smell, wondering what they'll wear and what they'll say the next time they see you. And on top of the constant dream state you're in, your stomach feels like it's connected to a bungee cord, and it bounces and bounces around for hours until it finally lodges itself next to your heart. That's how I've felt since the first day I met Sarah Hart. I can be training with Sam or trying to find my shoes in the back of our SUV, and the thought of Sarah's face and her lips and ivory skin take over me. I can be giving directions from the back seat and still be 100% focused on the way it feels when the top of Sarah's head rests just under my chin. And I can be surrounded by 20 Moogs, my palms just starting to light up, and I'll be analyzing every line of conversation from Thanksgiving dinner at Sarah's. But what's even more insane is that as we drive the speed limit towards paradise at 9 o'clock at night, as we drive right towards Sarah and her blonde hair and blue eyes, I'm also thinking about Six. I'm thinking about the way she smells, the way she looks in her training outfits, how he almost kissed back in Florida. My stomach also hurts because of Six. Not only because of her, but because of the fact my best friend also has a crush on her. I need to buy some antacids the next time we stop. While Sam drives, we debate Henri's letter and talk about how cool Sam's dad is for not only helping the people of Lorien, but also for giving Sam a riddle to find the transmitter device in case anything were to happen to him. And still, I'm going back and forth between Sarah and Six in my head. We're 2 hours from paradise when Six asks, "But what if it's nothing, though? I mean, what if there's nothing down in that well but some weird birthday present or anything else but the transmitter? We're risking a lot, like a lot
by showing up in paradise like this.
Trust me, Sam says.
He drums his thumbs on the steering wheel and turns up the stereo.
I've never been so certain of anything in my entire life, and I get straight A's, thank you very much.
I think the Mogadorians are there waiting, in far greater numbers than what we faced in Florida, watching everything that might lead them to us. And if I'm going to be honest with myself, the only reason I'm willing to take this risk is because of the possibility of seeing Sarah. I lean forward in the back seat and pat Sam's right shoulder. Sam, no matter what happens with that well and sundial, Six and I owe you big time for what your dad did for us. But I really, 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 really hope that it leads to a transmitter.
Don't worry, Sam says.
Highway lights come and go. Bernie Kosar's floppy ears fall from the edge of the seat as he sleeps. I'm nervous about seeing Sarah. Nervous about being so close to Six. Hey, Sam? I ask. You want to play a game?
Yeah, sure.
What do you think Six's Earth name is? Six whips her head over her shoulder, her raven hair slapping her right cheek, and she frowns at me in mock anger.
She has one? Sam laughs.
Just guess, I say. Yeah, Sam, Six says. Guess.
Striker.
I laugh so hard, Bernie Kosar jumps up to look out the nearest window.
Striker? Six yells. Not Striker, then. Okay. I don't know. Something like Persia or Eagle or...
Eagle? Six yells. Why would I be Eagle?
You're such a badass, you know? Sam laughs. I just figured he would be like a Starfire or like Thunderclap or something really badassy.
Exactly, I shout. That's totally what I thought, too.
So what is it, then? He asks.
Six crosses her arms and looks out the passenger side window. I'm not telling you until you make a real guess with a real girl's name.
Eagle Sam.
Give me some credit.
What? I'd name myself Eagle if I had the chance, Sam says. Eagle Good. That sounds pretty awesome, right?
It sounds like a brand of cheese, Six says. We all laugh at that.
Okay, Rachel, Sam says. Brittany.
Ooh, yuck, she says.
Fine, Rebecca. Claire. Oh, I know Beverly.
You are insane, Six laughs. She punches Sam's thigh, and he howls and rubs at it dramatically. He hits her back, a couple of knuckles on her left bicep, and she feigns severe pain. Her name is Marin Elizabeth, I say. Marin Elizabeth.
Ah, you gave it away, he says. I was going with Marin Elizabeth next.
Yeah, right, she says.
No, I was. Marin Elizabeth's pretty cool. Do you want us to start calling you that? Four goes by John, right, Four?
I scratch Bernie Kosar's head. I don't think I could get used to calling him Hadley. But maybe I could get used to calling Six Marin Elizabeth. I think you should take on a human name, I say. If not Marin Elizabeth, then something else. I mean, at least for when we're in front of strangers. Everyone grows silent, and I reach behind me into the chest for the velvet bag holding Lorien's solar system. I set the six planets and the sun in my palm and watch them hover and glow to life. As the planets begin to orbit their sun, I find that I am able to dim the brightness of their glow with my mind. I intentionally lose myself in them, successfully forgetting, just for a few moments,
that I might be seeing Sarah soon. Six turns to look at the faint solar system that floats in front of my chest, and then she finally says, I don't know. I still like the name Six. Marin Elizabeth was when I was a different person. And right now, Six just feels right. It can be short for something if someone asks.
Sam looks over.
For what? 60?
I set out 7 mugs and a kettle on the stove. While waiting for the water to boil, I crushed 3 of the pills I stole from Hector's mother into a fine powder with the rounded backside of a metal spoon. Ella stands beside me, watching as she always does when it's my turn to make the sisters' nightly tea.
What are you doing?
She asks.
Something I'm probably going to regret, I say. That's something I have to do.
Ella flattens a piece of crumpled paper on the table and places the tip of her pencil on it. Immediately, she's drawing a perfect picture of the 7 teacups I've lined up. From what I can get out of her, she met with a couple in Sister Lucia's office who said they had, quote, a lot of love to give. I'm not sure how long the meeting lasted, but Ella says they're coming back tomorrow. I know what it means, and I pour the boiling water from the kettle as slowly as I can, trying to prolong my time with her. Ella, how often do you think about your parents? I ask. Her brown eyes grow wide.
Today?
Sure. Today or any other day.
I don't know.
She trails off. After a pause, she adds,
A million times?
I bend down to hug her, and I don't know if it's because of how sorry I feel for her or how sorry I feel for myself. My parents are dead, too. The victims of a war I'm supposed to continue someday. I scoop the crushed pills into Adelina's teacup, regretting that I've resorted to drugging her. There's no other choice. She can stand by and wait for death, if that's what she chooses. But I refuse to give up or to go down without a fight, without doing everything within my power to survive. With the tray teetering in my hands, I leave Ella at the table and make my rounds. One by one, I hand the tea out around the orphanage, and when I'm ushered into the sisters' quarters to deliver Adelina her tea, I carefully shove her cup towards the front edge. She takes it with a polite nod. Sister Camilla is feeling ill this evening, and I have been asked to sleep in the children's quarters tonight for her.
Okay,
I say, as I think about the possibilities of Adelina and me being in the same room tonight. I watch her take a long sip from her teacup. I can't tell if I just made a huge mistake or helped my cause immensely. I will see you soon, then, she says. Then she winks at me. I'm taken aback, almost dropping the 2 remaining cups from my tray to the floor.
Oh, okay,
I stutter. When curfew comes a half hour later, nobody falls asleep right away, and instead, many girls whisper to one another in the dark. I lift my head every few minutes to look at Adelina lying on her bed across the room. Her wink has left me confused. 10 more minutes pass. I can tell most everyone is still awake, including Adelina. She's usually quick to fall asleep when she's on duty, so the fact that she's still up tells me that she's also waiting for everyone in the room to fall asleep. Now I think her wink definitely meant she wanted to resume our conversation. The room falls silent, and I wait before I lift my head. Adelina hasn't moved in the last half hour, so I move the left legs of her bed off the ground and tip her slightly. Suddenly, she raises her left arm above her like a white flag of surrender, and she points to the doorway. I toss the covers aside, stand, then tiptoe from the room. When I reach the hall, I slink a few paces into the shadows, holding my breath, hoping this isn't some sort of trap Adelina and Sister Dora have set up.
After 30 seconds, Adelina enters the hallway. Her walk is labored, and she sways from side to side. "Come with me," I whisper, taking her hand. I haven't held her hand in years, and it brings back the memory of us huddling together on the boat to Finland when I was sick and she was strong. We were once so close you couldn't slide a piece of paper between us. Now the mere touch of her hand feels alien. "I'm so tired," Adelina confesses as we climb to the second floor. We're halfway to the north wing and the belfry protected by the padlock. "I don't know what's wrong with me." I do. "Do you want me to carry you?"
"You can't carry me."
"Not with my arms," I say. She's too tired to argue. I focus on her feet and legs, and a few seconds later, I've lifted Adelina off the floor and begin to float her down the dusty corridors. We pass the ancient statues cut into the rock wall and enter the narrower hallway in silence. I worry that she's fallen asleep, but then she says, "I can't believe you're using telekinesis to fly an old lady like me down the hall. Where are we going?" "I had to hide it," I whisper. "We're almost there. I promise." I unlock the padlock, and it falls from the oak door's handle. And soon I'm following a floating Adelina up the stone stairway that circles around the north tower, leading to the belfry. I can hear Legacy faintly meowing from the top. I open the door to the belfry and set Adelina gently down next to the chest. She props her left arm up on the chest lid and leans her head against it. I can see she has just about lost her battle with the pills, and I'm angry with myself now for tricking her. Legacy climbs into her lap and licks her right hand. "How is there a cat in here?" she mumbles. "Don't ask. Listen, Adelina, you're almost completely asleep, and I need you to open the chest with me before you are, okay?"
"I don't think I have..."
"Have what?" I ask.
"Have it in me right now, Marina." Her eyes are closed.
"Yes, you do."
"Put your hand on the chest's lock. Put my hand on the other side." I press my palm against the side of the lock, and it feels warm. I use telekinesis to pull her right hand away from Legacy's tongue and onto the other side of the lock. She interlocks her fingers with mine. A second passes. The lock snaps open.
Guys? Something's totally happening back here.
The seven orbs that hover in front of my chest in the back seat of the SUV are speeding up, and I can no longer control them. It gets so bright that I have to cover my eyes.
"Hey! Hey! Dude, cut it out!"
Sam barks.
"I'm trying to drive up here."
"I don't know what's going on."
"Pull over!"
Six yells. Sam rips the vehicle onto the shoulder of the road and slams on the brakes, stone and gravel crunching and pinging us. The six planets and one sun dim in brightness, and the planets start to whip around the sun at such a rate that it's hard to focus on any single one. With each orbit, the planets are absorbed into the sun until it's the size of a basketball. The new globe rotates as though on an axis, and then it produces a flash of light so bright that I'm momentarily blinded. It slowly dims, and sections of its surface raise and recede until what's left behind is a perfect replica of Earth itself. All seven continents, all seven seas.
"Is that?" Sam asks. "That looks like Earth."
The planet spins near my head, and on its third or fourth rotation, I see a small pinprick of pulsing light.
"Do you guys see that little light?" I ask. "Look at Europe. Oh, yeah, Sam says. He waits for another rotation and then squints.
I would say that's in, what, Spain or Portugal? Can someone reach the laptop? Hurry!
With my eyes still on the globe and the tiny pulsing light, I crash my hand around behind me until I find the laptop. I hand it to Six, who hands it to Sam. He looks up at the globe hovering in the back seat, types, and looks up.
Well, it's definitely in Spain, and it looks to be close to, well, the closest city seems to be a place called León. But that's slightly off. We're looking at the Picos de Europa mountains for sure. Anyone ever heard of them?
Definitely not, I say. Me neither, Six says. Is that maybe our ship? I ask. No way. Not in Spain. Well, at least I highly doubt it, she says. I mean, if it is our ship, then why would it just start glowing now, showing us where it is? That wouldn't make any sense. Besides, you've looked at these things how many times?
A dozen, I say.
Maybe more.
Sam hugs his headrest and raises his eyebrows. Right. So it's as if something just activated it.
Six and I look at each other.
It could definitely be one of the others, Sam says.
Could be, Six says. Or it could be a trap. She looks at Sam. Has there been any suspicious news from Spain?
He shakes his head. Not as of 5 hours ago, but I'll check again right now.
He starts typing on the keyboard. Before you do that, let's get off the main road before someone notices there's a glowing planet of Earth floating in the car, I say. We're pretty damn close to paradise, remember?
Adelina snores, and I feel guilty. But for the first time in my life, I see the inheritance I should have received years ago. Rocks and gems of different colors, different sizes and shapes. A pair of dark gloves and a pair of dark glasses, both made of materials I've never seen before. There's a small tree branch with the bark pared away, and under that, there's an odd circular device with a glass lens and floating needle, not unlike a compass. But it's a glowing red crystal that has me most intrigued. Once I look at it, I can't look away, and I slowly reach down and take it in my hand. It's warm and tingly in my palm. For a brief second, the red light brightens, and then it fades and begins to slowly pulse at the same rate I breathe. The crystal grows hotter, brighter, and it begins to emit a low hum. I panic, nervous that one of my legacies has activated a Loric grenade.
Adelina!
I yell.
Wake up! Wake up, please!
She furrows her brow, and her snoring intensifies. With my free hand, I shake her shoulder.
Adelina!
I shake her harder, and as I do, I drop the crystal. It bounces hard on the belfry's stone floor and rolls towards the doorway. As it falls from the first stair to the second, the red light stops pulsing. As it falls from the second stair to the third, it stops glowing altogether. And as it falls to the fourth stair, I chase after it.
Sam zips us down a dark dirt road. The globe continues to whir in my face. The tiny pulsing light continues to try to tell us something. We come to a stop, and Sam kills the engine and lights.
So I'm thinking it's one of you guys, Sam says, turning around. It's another number, and that number is in Spain.
We have no way of knowing that, Six says. Sam nods at the globe.
Okay, look. You guys were meant to stay apart from one another when you first arrived, right? That's how it worked. You all go off in hiding until your legacies develop, and you train and everything. And then what? Then you get together and you fight together. So this light right here, maybe that's a signal to get together, or more likely, it's a distress signal from one of the remaining numbers. Or, guys, maybe number 5 or number 9 just opened up their chest for the first time, and because we have this thing running at the same time, we can communicate.
Maybe they see we're in Ohio then? I ask.
Shit. Maybe. Possibly. But seriously, think about it. If the elders were going to give you all this stuff in your chests, then they'd give you something to communicate with each other, right? Maybe we just unlock the key somehow, and we've got the location of someone who needs our help, he says.
Or maybe one of the others is getting tortured and they're being forced to contact us, and it's a trap, Six says.
Just as I'm about to agree, the edges of Earth grow fuzzy, and then the entire globe vibrates with a female voice that says,
Adelina, despierta, despierta, por favor, Adelina.
I'm about to yell back, but the globe suddenly shrinks, reforms into the 7 orbs, and returns to normal.
Whoa, whoa, whoa!
What just happened?
I ask.
I'd say the signal has been cut, Sam says.
Who is that girl? And who's Adelina? Six asks.
I catch the stone after it bounces off the 9th stair. But no matter what I do, it doesn't glow like it did before. I shake it in my palm. I blow on it. I set it in Adelina's open hand. It doesn't change from its new faint blue color, and I'm worried I broke it. I carefully set it back inside the chest and pick up the short tree branch. With a deep breath, I stick the branch out one of the 2 windows, and I concentrate on the opposite end. There's a bit of a magnetic force happening, but before I can really test it or figure it out, I hear the oak door at the bottom of the tower creak open.
Chapter 21. While we drive, I try a few more times to regain the signal with the globes. But every time I get the solar system up and running, they just orbit like normal. It's almost midnight, and I'm about to rifle through the other stones and objects in my chest. But it's then I see the scattered lights of a town on the horizon. A sign passes on my right just like it did a few months ago when Henri was behind the wheel. Welcome to Paradise, Ohio. Population, 5,243.
Welcome home, Sam whispers.
I press my forehead against the window and recognize a dilapidated barn, an old sign for apples, a green pickup still for sale. A warm feeling comes over my entire body. Of all the places I've ever lived, paradise has been my favorite. It's where I made my first best friend. It's where I developed my first legacy. It's where I fell in love. But paradise was also where I met my first Mogadorians, where I had my first real battle and felt real pain. It's the place where Henri died. Bernie Kosar jumps onto the seat next to me, and his tail wags at an amazing rate. He shoves his nose through the small crack in his window, and he sniffs furiously at the familiar air. As we take the first side road on the left and make several more turns, backtracking here and there, making sure we're not being followed, finding the best and least conspicuous place to leave the SUV, we go over the plan once more.
After we get the transmitter, we go right back to the car and we leave paradise immediately, Six says. Right?
Right, I say.
We don't make contact with anyone else. We just go. We leave.
I know she's referring to Sarah, and I bite my lip. Finally, after all these weeks on the run, I'm back in paradise and I'm told I can't see Sarah.
Got it, John? We leave? Right away?
Lay off already.
I know what you're getting at.
Sorry.
Sam parks the SUV on a dark street under a maple tree 2 miles from his house. My shoes drop to the asphalt. My lungs take their first real breath of paradise air, and I instantly want to go back to how it was, back to Halloween, back to coming home to Henri, back to sitting on my couch next to Sarah. We don't take any chances of losing my chest in an unguarded car, so Six opens the back door and lugs it onto her shoulder. Once comfortable, she makes herself invisible.
Wait, I say.
I want something out of there first. Six? Six reappears, and I open the chest and retrieve the dagger, slipping it into the back pocket of my jeans. Okay, now I'm ready. Bernie Kosar, buddy, are you ready?
Bernie Kosar transforms into a small brown owl, and he flaps his way onto a low branch of the maple tree.
Let's do this already.
Six picks up my chest and disappears again. Then we run. With Sam trailing at a good pace, I jump a fence and pick up speed on the edge of the nearest field. After a half mile, I'm veering into the forest, loving the way the branches break off my chest and arms, how the tall patches of grass whip my jeans. I look over my shoulder often, and Sam is never farther than 40 yards behind me, jumping over logs, sliding under branches. There is a noise beside me, but before I can reach for my dagger, Six whispers that it's just her. I see a swatch of grass part down the middle, and I follow. Luckily, Sam lives on the outskirts of paradise with large yards separating each neighbor. I stop just inside the lip of the forest when his house comes into view. It's a small, modest house with white aluminum siding and black shingles, a thin chimney on its right side, a tall wooden fence enclosing the backyard. Six materializes and sets down my chest.
That it?
She asks.
That's it.
30 seconds later, Bernie Kosar lands on my shoulder. 4 minutes go by until Sam lumbers through a line of brush and stands next to us, out of breath, his palms planted firmly on his thighs. He looks up at his house in the distance.
How are you feeling? I ask.
Like a fugitive. Like a bad son.
Think about how proud your dad would be if we pull this off, I say.
Six turns herself invisible to run reconnaissance, checking the shadows of the nearby houses, the back seats of every car on the street. She returns and says everything looks okay, but there are some motion sensor lights on the house on the right. Bernie Kosar flies away, perching himself on the highest point of the roof. Six grabs Sam's hand, and they turn invisible. I tuck the chest under my arm and quietly follow them to the back fence. They reappear, and Six goes over first, then Sam. I toss the chest over and climb quickly after. We duck behind an overgrown shrub, and I survey the backyard and its trees, high grass, a big tree stump, a rusty swing set, and an antique wheelbarrow on its side. There's a back door on the left side of the house, and 2 dark windows on the right.
There it is, Sam whispers, pointing.
What I first thought was a tree stump peeking out of the middle of the yard is actually, upon closer inspection, a wide stone cylinder. Squinting, I see a triangular object sticking up off its top.
We'll be right back, Six whispers to Sam.
My hand in Six's, I turn invisible and say,
Okay, Eagle Good. Guard that chest as if my life depends on it. Because it does.
Six and I carefully walk through the high grass towards the well and then kneel in front of it. Numbers border the circumference of the sundial. 1 through 12 on the left side, and another 1 through 12 on the right. 0 at the top, and the numbers are surrounded by a series of lines. I'm about to grip the middle triangle and twist randomly when I hear Six gasp.
What?
I whisper, raising my eyes to the dark back windows.
In the middle, look,
The symbols.
I study the sundial again, and my breath is caught in my